Welcome to the Senior Man Podcast Show. We are engaging with the senior men of our service who are willing to invest in us for mission welfare. I want to thank Fire Engineering for giving us the ability to engage the fire service through this podcast. Tonight, in episode 3 of the Senior Man, we will be going over Chief William Clark's Firefighting Principles and Practices, second edition. Chief Clark served with Chief Freed from our previous studies. We are motivated to go through the text with you tonight. I'm your host, Jeff Rothmeyer, currently serving with the St. Paul Fire Department. I'm honored to be the captain of the Knights of Pain on Engine 17. Joining me tonight, gentlemen, roll call. For the engine, manning the nozzle tonight, Shoop. Shoop, you out there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, Jeff. Always a pleasure learning the nozzleman's scope of practice from you.
Thank you.
For the truck, manning the irons tonight, Pressler. Bob?
Good evening.
Welcome, Bob. We hope to delve into some high-rise fire rescue tactics with you tonight.
So, sounds good.
Excellent. So for our first order of business, gentlemen, we have a question from a listener. Contact us on Facebook. We'll dive right in. When not surrounded by a positive attitude, how do we stay motivated for the long haul? What have you guys done to get through the thinner years? Let's start with you, Jeff.
One of those,
go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, Jeff. Now, Jeff can rhyme in there. You can start.
Yeah, give me that one more time, okay? How do we get through? Yeah, go on.
So, when not surrounded by a positive attitude, how do we stay motivated for the long haul? And what have you guys done to get through the thinner years?
Bob, you want me to start?
Absolutely.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, in other words, how did the guy come into the job, fall in love with the job, the job means so much to him, and how does he carry that throughout his career despite his working conditions or the people he's with who might not have the same outlook that he does, right?
Correct, yeah. You know, a lot of times complacency sets in, and especially if you don't get fire activity, it gets even worse.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know. I think there's just a lot of things to point out. Number one, not everybody who comes into the job is cut out to be a firefighter. And that's the one thing that I think we fall trapped to. Well, everybody says, oh, I want to be a fireman. They take the test. They work hard to get on the job. Some guys, they just carry a positive attitude with them. Others, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, they go through a change or whatever, you know. And other guys just were there for whatever reason to come on the job. We're all different. That's the thing. We all are different. And human chemistry, by the way, if you put guys in a firehouse, not everybody may blend together. And that's another thing that may make for an unhappy work environment for the guy who feels he has the superior or the better attitude, or he looks at the job as it's wonderful and I need to be on it all the time. And that's, you know, that's not reality. And, you know, there's just so many cases you can think of out there. You know, some kids, you know, come on a job, they wanted to be a fireman from the time they were a little kid. They got to live out their dream. So there's other things that can step in the way. A person comes on the job and something happens, maybe because of local conditions, maybe a court-ordered injunction against, you know, something that happened in the fire department. Fire companies are taken out of service. Staffing has been reduced on fire companies and whatever. A person might be unhappy with the promotional system for whatever reason. That can change people's ideas and attitudes about the job also. So that's quite a loaded question right there, I think. So,
Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, having been in a department that was like that, the biggest thing and probably the hardest is you can't let them drag you down. You have a commitment to this job. You want to learn this job. You have to make time to do the things that you can. And if you do it by yourself for a while, you know what? So be it. You can't control everyone. You can't fix everyone. But that doesn't mean that you can give up on what you are doing and what you try to do. Where's this laugh in the firehouse? Go out, take the chainsaw out of the compartment, start taking it apart. Next thing you know, someone will be there going, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And then tell them, oh, listen, I can't put it back together. You know, you can drag people into helping you, but the biggest thing is you have to realize that you can't be responsible for everybody else. You can only be responsible for yourself. And if you have an attitude that tries to drag other people in, hopefully you'll drag some in. We've always looked at the point that, you know, how big is your fire department? If you're a one-house fire department, it might be tough to get other people to get into what you want to do. If you're in a multi-house fire department, find the houses that interest you. Find the houses that are trying to do what you like, the busier houses normally, and try to get there. The biggest thing I can recommend, though, is don't let them drag you down to their level. Stay above them. Keep working hard. Keep learning your profession. Be a student of the game. And eventually, either people gravitate to you or you'll find the place that you need to be with like-minded individuals.
I like that, Bob. I look at it in similar fashion. And for a time when things were a little bit slower around my area, I started getting mired in this negativity, you know, drilling a lot, people having their words about what we're doing and what type of drills we're doing and if it was worthwhile and things of this nature. And I just realized at a certain point, this is a campaign. And I can either be on the campaign to apathy and to negativity, which sometimes I feel surrounds us and can, or I can be on the campaign to effectiveness and sharpening the iron and getting better at my craft. Like you said, being a student of the game. And my disposition, I'm noticing, has a lot to do and a lot to say on if I'm able to get a few people on the wagon. So, yeah, I try to stay positive and stay committed to that mission regardless of, I guess, the external factors, because really they're irrelevant to what my purpose is. So,
very tough as a fireman, easier as an officer.
Correct.
Because as an officer, you have control of that firehouse on your tour. And if they don't like it, they can move. And you can help them move, and you'll get people that want to be part of what you're doing. A little bit tougher as a firefighter.
No doubt. And I'm actually always motivated when I see firefighters pushing that type of change and positive reinforcement from their seats in the back. It motivates me to get off my butt and push a little bit harder as well. So,
absolutely.
All right. Well, we're going to move into our first section of text with Chief Clark here. I got a lot of takeaways from some of the command and leadership impetus that Chief Clark has in his book. So we'll get rolling right from the beginning. Chief Clark, early in the text, started talking about a lot of the advancement in firefighting over the past 60 years. Super pumpers, high expansion foam, all kinds of specialized equipment. And while that was all fine and dandy, he mentions the most significant improvements in this fashion. While it is true that these are improvements, they do not give the fire service new techniques. If a fire chief of 100 years ago could be brought back to life and put in charge of a fire today, he would be fairly well at home. His methods and orders would be understood because they would be the same as those that would be given by his present-day successor, who would find slightly more powerful artillery but a smaller infantry. His strategy and tactics would have to be altered only to allow for those differences. If there has been a truly significant advance in firefighting in the 20th century, it has been in the field of training. Not much more is known now than was 75 years ago, but it is known by far more people. The knowledge that was once exclusively held by a few is now available to many. So, Jeff, let's start out with you. Do you believe that a chief from our past would comfortably and competently run a scene today?
No. I think when the book, you know, was written, you didn't have a lot of the stuff that you see now about command from a distance. And I just think that some of the things that are expected of an incident commander today, who goes along with some of the new acronyms or whatever they are, rhymes or whatever, to figure out their job. No, I don't think they'd be comfortable today with what's out there. In the past, you know, I remember working with some older battalion chiefs and assistant chiefs, and you know, like in any situation, you know, there were some that were okay, and there were some that were very good, and there were some that were not good in their jobs and so forth. But the good chiefs back in the days, they were all over that fire. They weren't sitting in a chief's rig half a block away with headphones on and drawing pictures about what they think they're hearing over the radio. Some of the old chiefs, and the ones that I thought were very good and very competent, were all around that fire building. They're watching the progress of firefighting. I can tell you, if fire's coming out of a building and there's no hose lines movement, if there's no steam or there's no diminishing of smoke, they knew something was wrong. And a lot of those older chiefs were on top of accountability before it even became a buzzword in the fire service. They knew who was on those hose lines because you had different discipline back then. You didn't have freelancing and stuff like that. You had a company level officer who would say, you're the nozzle man, you're the backup man, here's my pump operator, and that's it. You know, it wasn't a thing where you just go freelance, do what you think you had to do. No. And that was one thing where that helped the chiefs in their accountability. So when there was, you know, a changing situation in the fire ground and head counts were taken and so forth, you know. So I just think that statement might not be too accurate. Yeah, I guess I'm being kind here compared to today's what we see out there.
Bob, sounds like you have some thoughts.
Oh, I actually think he would do just fine. But hear me out. Because just because we've changed all the names and titles and designations and divisions instead of floors and fire attack instead of engine companies, he was a gentleman that was set in his ways, that ran his fires by the things that he believed. And he may not call things what they are today, but I think he'd be very competent in running a fire. Now, if you put him into a NIMS environment, he might get some people pissed off because he didn't call things the right way. But he was a student of the game, and he had his priorities. And that's one of the things, you know, I read a post the other night about the modern fire ground and the modern fires we're going to. But how long can we use that as an excuse for not doing our job? You know, is Martin in the last 2 years, the last 5 years, since you all and this have been doing fast, the last 10 years, how long can this modern fire environment be an excuse for not doing what we're supposed to be doing? So I think Chief Clark, in his book, outlined how he ran fires. And I don't think we run them much different today. I think we just call them a lot of different things. So I think the points that he used to command the fire are still fine today, although his terminology would probably need a little bit of an updating.
Okay. What would surprise him if he was on our scene in modern fire attack? What would surprise him about the actions he would start seeing on the fire ground?
Hitting it hard from the yard.
Jeff, do you have anything else that would surprise him with our actions?
Oh, I don't know. I think I mentioned freelancing, you know. If you're talking a small operation, the stationary incident commander. Okay. I got to be there. I got to be visible. I got to be out in the front, you know, and not really watching or paying attention to how the fire is going, rather than just being somebody to listen to the radio, and as other mutual aid or automatic aid comes in, that person's available. They're invisible. And I'm thinking, well, that's, no, no. But I think that would be something.
Okay. All right, well, Chief Clark also has some impetus on basement fires that I thought would be real quick to go over, pertinent. One of them is talking about ventilation. Ventilation, however, should be started on arrival immediately upon ascertaining that a protecting hose line is in position and charged. Start at the bottom with the opening of any basement windows that may be present. The store should then be ventilated front and rear and show windows broken out if conditions warrant it. In a multi-story building, the roof and upper floors will probably have to be open. Bob, how do we effectively vent a basement fire with limited access?
Well, from this text, I think we're talking about firing a row of stores in either a taxpayer, one or two-story building, or actually in the multiple dwelling is the store on the first floor. And that becomes part of our issue. So the first problem is always identifying the fact that we have a basement fire. And then once we decide that we definitely have a basement fire, it's identifying the openings that are natural to the building. Any windows, any rear access. If we're talking about private houses or townhouse, walking back, walking access from the backyards or rear access. But if we're talking truly about that taxpayer, it's very limited what we can do. We look for openings in the front sidewalk for deliveries. We possibly could open up underneath the showroom windows. We can open up underneath the floors in those showrooms or those front plate glass windows to get some access. You know, basement fires in that type of building, very hard to ventilate. The roof ventilation becomes a priority in a one-story taxpayer. Starts to clear out the selling floor or the first floor and gives us a little bit of operating clearance to try to get some openings in the floor to that basement. But basement fires in a taxpayer, very, very hard to get enough ventilation to get that engine moving down the stairs.
Okay, copy that. So that was the context. I didn't provide it when I asked, but it is a store basement fire, so we'll keep moving forward. The first step in combating a store basement fire should be to guard against upward extension. The interior stairway is the most vulnerable avenue, and a hose line should be placed at the top of it. Walls should be felt for signs of heat and water inserted if necessary. An aggressive attack should be attempted in the basement itself with a sufficiently large nozzle and hose. Usually a 2.5-inch line is needed. Its weight is not a great handicap because it will be moved down and forward, not up a stairway, and there is no problem of water damage below the fire floor. Jeff, do you agree with the tactics of venting aggressively and using 2.5-inch lines on these type of taxpayer or store basement fires?
Well, I absolutely agree with venting aggressively. You know, it's always a good thing when you hear the saws running, you know, you hear things opening up. And basement fires in these types of buildings, you have to look for other ways in many cases. You know, if you're planning on making all your attacks in a fire like this through the front door, trying to find a stairway that goes down into a basement, no, that's not going to work in most cases. If it's well involved, I mean, you know, zero visibility, things like that. And to take fire departments that have these buildings, remember, we're in an era when you talk about 2.5, and you might train with 2.5, but when the real thing hits, to take a 2.5 in to the stairway like this, you're going down a hallway, you're making a 180 and then taking that line down. Yeah, well, we know that the weight of the hose will help take it down. You've got to have these guys in positions under those conditions to make it happen. Number two, the thing I see which is defeating in this situation is the lines over pumped. This is a low pressure hose line right here. So 2.5 is low pressure, high volume. And in too many cases, the line is over pumped and making it hard for the guys to manipulate. And so when they got to make that 180 go down those stairs, it's a hard thing to do. And generally, when you cannot make that bend and the nozzle's halfway down the stairs, what do they tell you about that position of the stairway? That's the one of the most murderous positions you got. You're not able to get down there, not able to get down to the bottom of the stairs where it might be a little bit better, but that's the thing, you know. And if you got a 2.5 going into a situation like this, you obviously have a pretty good working fire ahead of you, and it's going to overpower you. So that's why I make that point about finding other ways into the building, like rear entrance ways, rear basement steps that go down into like outside stairways that go down into the basement, things like that. You got to find other ways in. So,
excellent. So moving forward, Chief Clark has an outline of a post-fire analysis that I found very helpful and insightful. So some of the notes he made on it was that there are lessons to be learned from fires if the subject is properly approached. It is a delicate area because the disclosure of error can become personal. Therefore, an effort should be made to keep the study objective and impersonal. A well-developed and well-structured critique format, which permits the objectivity desired without sacrificing its values as a means of improving efficiency. So, in essence, let's have a standard template, and if we go down the template, maybe we can curb some of the accusatory perceptions that might be in the crowd when we're talking about actions that need some improvement. When I started going through this questionnaire guide, it was some of your basic stuff. Let's talk about response. Were the proper equipment and personnel dispatched? Was a correct route taken? Some of that's kind of known. Talked about locating the point of fire origin, determining the cause of the fire, hose streams or hose streams properly directed and applied. Finally, where I took some of the best, where I became more curious was the last point of this template that he has mentioned on page 289. He goes, number 18, your composure. Were you in command of yourself as well as in command of the fire situation? Were your actions and attitudes those of a leader? So, Bob, how vital is composure on the fire ground?
Well, if you look at what the chief wrote, he's talking about running that critique from a chief's position. And, it's one of those things that we've all gone to fires where when we pulled up and saw Chief X in front of the fire building, we were all pretty comfortable knowing that that was the person that was going to help us get through this fire. We've also been to the fire where Chief Y was standing in front, and we're like, oh, no, this isn't going to go well. So it's an important point for not only the firefighters and company officers going through the fire, but the chief himself to realize that your composure on the fire ground is going to set the tone for that fire. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we were teaching RIF classes when it was still new, and we ran into a ton of resistance because we said that one of the things that the RIT officer, the company officer in charge of the RIT, had to do is evaluate the chief officer. And he had to evaluate it to determine if something went wrong, was the command going to help him or hinder him? And that's a real-life problem. So I think it's a great thing for him to put in his critique that we have to judge ourselves. The people come up to you at the command post and say, Chief, what do you need? And have every ounce of faith that what you're going to tell them is the best thing to happen. Do they come up cringing? And our problem in the fire service is that's a lot of self-examination. That where do we fit in there? And we all have examples. I can tell you places I've gone on automatic aid or mutual aid and seen the chief standing out front and going, well, hopefully we can put this out without them, or pulling up and saying, I'm glad they're there because this should go pretty smooth. So it's a great point, but very, very tough for the American Fire Service to check ourselves.
Jeff, how does one develop composure on the fire ground?
Oh, God, it takes time. And it takes experience. It takes knowledge. And I think it comes down to the person also. And the person themselves and how they, again, compose themselves. Some people, you know, you think, yeah, this guy was okay as a fireman. The guy got promoted. All of a sudden, this guy turned out to be a gangbuster. You thought, oh, this guy's pretty cool. The officer of a company, of a crew, who knows he's got good people and lets them work and doesn't say much, there's a mutual thing there. And I've been in those situations. And it to me, is tremendous. I had an officer that I worked with many years ago, and he just had that command presence. And, you know, you'd go to a fire with him, and the chiefs looked at our officer, who was one of the senior officers on the department, and, you know, you could see that chief was happy to see him there. And, again, he felt, oh, here's a chief who's going to let this company work. So that's, like I say, a give-and-take thing right there, or a mutual thing right there, mutual respect for both. So.
Bob, if you could add one nugget for a young company officer to start a practice, if you will, to start gaining more composure on the fire ground, what would you tell him?
Well, as Jeff was talking, I was thinking about a couple of things, but I have to tell you, I do a lot of teaching out at the Fire Department Training Network in Indianapolis, and we do an officer's class, and this question comes up quite a bit. And the biggest thing is, for the young officer, is you have to be smarter than everyone you meet. And I mean that only in that just because you got promoted doesn't mean you're done learning. And the more you know, that's where you'll draw your comfort from. You know, when you go to a fire and it's the first time you've been exposed to that, you've already done yourself a disservice. So what you need to do is keep learning, keep educating yourself. So when you go to that working fire, things that you experience aren't a shock to you, that you get to put the experience up against some knowledge that you thought you had, and see how close those two parallel, and then learn from that. And the biggest way to be comfortable is to be comfortable with what you're doing. So, you know, you're talking about stretching a line, putting a line in service, conducting searches. All these things, there's so much training to be done to go with those points. So when you actually experience them at a fire ground, it's not like, oh, my gosh, what do I do now? It's like, okay, find the first floor, get a line in the front door, get a line in the scene of the fire, get people searching upstairs into the bedrooms. They're not surprises because we've talked about them, we've drilled on them, they've come up in our classes, they come up in command classes, they come up on what we're going to carry ourselves as officers and what we're going to do.
Yeah, the lack of composure from my experience, I've gone to fire grounds and struggled with composure before as a young officer, and then from just military experience and having composure on a stressful scene in the combat zone, I felt a lot more comfortable at times in the military than I did in my early days as a fire, not only a firefighter, but a fire officer. And it was because I was inoculated in all the risks. The military takes control of their culture, and they make sure that you're inoculated with everything that you're going to be. You're basically desensitized to some of the aspects of combat before you get there. And so you can focus on your job, which is the composure. And then the absence of composure, I noticed, was just my emotional reaction to something I wasn't desensitized to. I wasn't inoculated with my environment enough. There was so many different situations that I didn't get exposed to in my base level of training, that the first time I was exposed to them was on the fire ground. And of course, I didn't know it at the time, but yeah, my lack of composure, maybe by moving more aggressively than I was efficiently, was that byproduct. So I agree with your thoughts on that one. you know, the more we train and the more.
But it's realistic training. That's the part we can't forget. It has to be realistic. You know, so many states are now against 1403. We can't burn anything because, unfortunately, other members of the fire service made a track record of killing and burning people during live fire training that now we can't do it. So we have a whole group of firefighters that the first fire they go to is the first fire they go to, which is completely insane.
Right.
You know, so there's a whole culture in our fire service right now based on safety that is actually making us unsafe. And until people realize that and fix the problem, and that's having unqualified people do burns, then we're going to continue to suffer from these early injuries, early fatalities on firefighters that come out of rookie school have never gone through a real fire.
I can tell you of a major city that runs EMS, of a lieutenant with 5 years being promoted, or a firefighter, let me say, a firefighter with 5 years being promoted. He was on a medic unit for those first 5 years. Now he's a lieutenant on a fire company. Isn't that a statement? And then the other thing, too, again, we need to protect time in the business on this job. You're asking about composure. How do we gain composure? Again, to me, that's something that's learned over time. It's through your experience, through your knowledge, through your street actions and things like that, that put together in your own personal library in your head. So when you do become an officer or do become a senior firefighter, you know, where people are looking to you or you're leading a company, that you've got something to fall back on. We got to get out of this thing where young people are qualified to be company-level officers with 3.5-4 years on a job. That's failure right there. That's a failure of your promotional system as far as I'm concerned. You know, we're not all equal in this job. We're not.
I've said for many years, knowledge without experience is only theory. And that's the truest statement in the fire service. You can have all the book smarts, you can have all the things you need, but until you go to a fire and try to wrap it all together, you are only guessing. Because unfortunately, fire doesn't play by the same books that we do all the time.
Right.
And I think that's a big problem in the fire service. We have book smart people that haven't gone to a fire.
Yeah. A phrase I heard, just a short phrase about young officers, or in fact, all officers, I guess, was used. And that was, be honest about your limitations. I thought, holy cow. And this was in one of those company officer classes. Be honest about your limitations. I worked in a busy Cleveland company for a long, long time. We had officers coming and going and so forth for whatever reason. We get this one officer coming into the company, and after lunch one day, because he comes into the company and he realized who he was dealing with. He went upstairs in his lieutenant's room, read a passage out of the training book, came downstairs and tried to quiz the guys. You don't think the guys were sharp on that? You don't think the guys knew what this guy was all about at that point?
Yeah, humility goes a long ways, and unfortunately, it seems like ego much of the time is preventing humility from stepping up and you know, which also ultimately prevents growth from occurring in any of those individuals who aren't, you know, rooted in that humbleness. So, all right, well, let's keep trucking here. We kind of touched on this earlier in part of our earlier conversation, but Chief Clark's got some impetus on establishment of a command post. The question often arises as to where the incident commander should station himself. One school of thought believes that the officer should establish and never leave a command post. Another thinks that he should be able to roam and thus make a better diagnosis of the fire situation by getting several points of view. The latter theory has received additional support since portable radios have become available for fireground use, enabling the first in command to maintain contact with the command post while he surveys the whole scene. However, provisions should be made for radio failure, which could be disastrous if the first in command were to be without a radio contact for the duration of his walk around the fire. Therefore, when he leaves the command post, he should leave someone in charge with authority to make command decisions during his absence. In this way, continuity of command can be maintained, and yet the first in command can get an expanded view of the situation, which will better enable him to make the right decisions. So, Bob is an incident commander more effective in his buggy or taking a lap?
Well, a couple of things come into play. One, size of the first alarm response, size of your department, and the type of fire. I, for years now, have talked about a tactical fire versus a strategic fire. In a tactical fire, the engine company officer, the truck company officer, are probably going to mitigate 90% of what we go to. And there, the chief is really an observer. If you have strong policies that your companies operate by, the chief should be in front of the fire building watching the fire building. Of course, everybody else has got something that they're supposed to be doing. Pushing the first line, getting the searches done, stretching the backup line, getting the water supply. And again, this will only be... it'll only be based on what you have set up for your department. But in the strategic fire, if you pull up and you have a building under construction between a real tight neighborhood where you have exposure problems and how many buildings are going to catch on fire, then you also have to assume command and try to limit the fire spread until the chief officer gets there. So, you know, you got to look at it two ways. Is it a tactical fire? Is it a strategic fire? And that's really going to dictate what that officer is going to do and how we're going to look at that fire. If I'm the chief coming in and I know I have a room or a room or two in a private house, I'm going to take command, but I'm not going to be in one fixed spot. I'm going to walk up, look at the fire building, take a look around back. I can move because I have a tactical fire. My company officers should be taking care of that fire. If I come down the block and I have a four-story building under construction that's now spreading to exposures, I'm parking the fuse car back where I can get a look at it, and I'm going to run that fire from there because that fire needs the big picture look. It's strategic, not tactical.
That's a good point. You brought that up in one of our previous previous episodes, and appreciate more of the dissection of how that actually plays out on the fire ground. In Chief Clark's book here, he starts mentioning vertical command and horizontal command, and one paragraph kind of stood out as he described some of these thoughts and how decisions are being made on the fire ground. Independence of thought may be desirable, but independence of action could be quite harmful. An officer who has an idea for action should get approval for the action if it may affect other operations. As Keith Royer has stated, the free enterprise system of firefighting can lead to chaos and often does. Officers should, however, be encouraged to use initiative and take action that is consistent with the strategic and tactical objectives. The old military axiom, do what you are told, no less and no more, may be based on the experience of Napoleon at Waterloo. It starts developing that theory more and more, so we'll break it there. But, Jeff, officers being allowed to operate decentralized in nature, making decisions apart from command, what are the practical limits between being helpful and harmful in that operational mode?
Well, I think the practical limit is the department that you're talking about in this situation, dealing with a 2.5-story frame house, in other words, a bread-and-butter operation. And does this department run engines and ladders? Does it employ that concept? So if you're arriving on an engine, you should be expected to operate as an engine company would, and that's a discipline within the department. And if a ladder company's coming in, you know, you expect them to do the truck work, not to, you know, run attack lines or whatever, because if they don't do their job, then another part of the fire fails. So the chief gets there, and if nobody's doing what they're supposed to do according to the plan, then you got chaos. And of course, this is how we burn buildings down. This is how firefighters get lost or unaccountable. The situation turns to crap, you know, and this is what we read about or hear about, and so forth. So, you know, that, I think that's what it is. It's having, like, SOPs to fit your department. SOPs that define company operations, whether the first engine, the second engine, the third engine, your ladder companies. If you run a couple of ladder companies, you know, what does the first one do? What does the second one do? You know, and that's it. You know, expected norms operate within. As long as you do that, I think it gets everybody on the same page initially. Fire ground, as we all know, it's dynamic. It can change. You know, it can change for whatever reason. But, you know, as long as we maintain those courses, I think, you know, that's what we're talking about here.
Sure.
Jeff brings up a great point, is that you're supposed to act the way you're responding. But in order to do that, what does your department have to have? Some kind of plans for the order in which you respond. So if three engines pull up first, you know, they pull one, two, three into the block, and they race to get the first line, your procedures suffer.
Yeah.
The first new engine is the first new engine. If they beat you by 2 feet, they beat you by 2 feet, you need to do second new engine work. Well, what does that entail? Well, if no one's talked about it, then you're a first new engine that's 2 feet behind the other first new engine. So
this goes right back to what we were talking a couple of minutes ago about company officers and their competency. So whether you're the first, second, or third engine officer, you know, as you're pointing out here, you know, if we're first, fine, this is what we're going to do. Second officer, this is what he knows has to be done to keep the scene going and so forth. So
absolutely. It's the dirty word in the fire service is discipline. And it's not discipline because you did something wrong. It's discipline because you're not doing something right. You know, you pull up first do, your job is stretch the line. If they beat you by your foot in your second do, well, you got to swallow your pride and make sure they have water and stretch a second line. And that's one of our little problems in fire services, that I'd rather race you to be first do than worry about the job I'm supposed to be doing. And, that, you know, it goes a long way to have the discipline to make sure that you do what you're supposed to do. Look at a first new engine that has, lucky enough to have four-man staffing. You know, has an operator, an officer, a nozzle man, and a backup. They all have jobs. Well, add the fifth guy, what does he become, a freelancer? No, he has a job. If you run with six, which is unheard of in most places, everyone has a job on the engine. Learn your job and do that job. It's called discipline. The most efficient companies are the ones that have discipline in their jobs.
Let me throw something else in here about line placement and discipline also. So let's go back to that 2.5-story frame. And you have a fire that starts in a room on the first floor of this old wood frame house. Okay, the first line gets in there. Your engines just arrive in that order like you're pointing out. One, two, and three. First engine gets a line. First line placement goes to the lowest point of where the fire started. Okay, so they start attacking the fire. By now, the fire has extended upstairs and is now involving a couple of rooms. Here comes the second line, and they are going upstairs. They got good fire up there, okay? The first line has got to hold its position. Even though those guys on the second line are getting the bulk of the fire upstairs now, first line has got to hold their position. Even though you might have some guys who are full of piss and vinegar, they want to get up there and be part of that fun, they got to hold their position there. Especially when you're in a room like this or a building like this and you have a vertical artery like the stairways, because that also holds whatever could develop on the first floor that wasn't taken care of or wasn't knocked down initially. That protects those guys' egress. So there's the discipline, that D word again coming in, holding your position and operating within the expected norms.
And it falls back to what you said earlier. That's the company officer's decision. You know, if that second new engine is delayed and the second floor is taken off, you might take the first line to the second floor and then tell the second new engine to mop up the first floor because you only had a room down there. Yep. But to back out before the first floor is controlled to race the second new engine to the floor above is when we get in problems. Again, that discipline, company officers, this is that knowing your position, knowing your job, and making a sound fire ground decision.
That's circumstantial, and I'm glad you made that point, too. This is the circumstances that we run across. It isn't a perfect world out there. We're not always going to have that second engine there within 2 minutes after the arrival of the first engine. We might be fighting a fire for a while before any help gets there. So that the decision that that company officer makes, and by the way, this brings up something else that I saw on the fire service out there this year. Major city out there does not expect to have its company officer their engines on the hose line. They are, when they arriving first, they can send a couple of firefighters in with the hose line while the company officer stays in the cab, establishes radio communication and things like that. I'm thinking, this is crazy when I hear stuff like this.
It's the incident command system at its finest.
Oh, yeah.
You know, again, that's what they're supposed to do. Establish command.
You want to talk about firefighter safety. Why isn't that officer with the nozzle then? You got a couple of young, inexperienced firefighters going into maybe a three-story apartment building, fire on the second floor of this one suite, and they got a smoke-filled hallway. What do you really think you're creating here?
No, absolutely, Jeff. It could even be a private house. How do you send rookie firefighters in alone? You know, the only good thing is Don Abbott, with his study on Maydays, has started to expose some of this for exactly what it is. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's 72% of all Maydays are where the company officers stayed outside. I mean, what a telling percentage of Maydays where we sent firefighters in unsupervised.
Unbelievable.
And I'd have to look it up. I'm not sure it's 72%. It's a very high percentage.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, who are you supervising sitting in the cab? Go with your crew, put water on the fire, make things better.
So to summarize some of your thoughts on this, is it possible? So we talked a lot about discipline when it comes to your role, whether you're a firefighter, you're the nozzle man, you're the backup man, whatever your role is on the fire ground, staying disciplined in that. Has the fire service itself lost discipline to some of these principles, we'll call them, of your officer being supervising at the IDLH? You know, he's at the fuel flame interface, you know, basically the front lines. Have we lost our discipline to keep that officer in that position? And why have we done that? Have we tried to reinvent the fire service because we had some injuries or some line of duty deaths, and maybe there wasn't a strong command presence, so we're gonna lose our discipline to try to put a band-aid on something else? Is that how that kind of has occurred over the years in your guys' perspective?
It's a pretty loaded question you're asking there. but absolutely.
Yeah.
We've made excuses all along for what happens. I said it before, the modern fire ground, well, is that this week, this month, this year, the last 2 years, 5 years? How long can we use that as a band-aid for what we're experiencing? I read a post the other night where a guy was referring to a rescue that was made, and all the moderator could talk about was, well, in the modern fire ground. Well, does that mean everyone that's been rescued under the last 5 years doesn't fit the modern fire ground? Is that the last week? We're caught in this vortex of everything has to have a phrase and how to operate and what we do, And it goes back to what we talked about earlier. Chief Clark would do fine right now because he understood how to put out a fire. He didn't classify the one-room fire with Class A material burning versus the taxpayer fire versus the commercial building fire. He had a list of things that work to put out fires. And we have to get back to that. We've lost our way because we're getting into terminology and quick fixes and new terms, you know, flow path. I wrote an article, it's got to be 25 years ago, that said when you open the door, you let air in, the fire's going to grow. I didn't call it anything. and that's what we're caught in now. It's got to have a term or we can't understand it. If I can't tag it, I can't use it. It's gotten silly.
So we've lost a bit of discipline. That's something that hopefully we can start bringing back through this show and some other aspects. And moving forward with our text, Chief Clark starts talking about the company officer again. Certain intangibles, such as the ability and attitudes of the officers present. Let me restart that. Certain intangibles, such as the ability and attitudes of the officers present, and the moral of the firefighters they command, are considerations of the utmost importance to the commanding officer weighing his resources. One good officer is worth a dozen poor ones, and usually, but not always, a company is no better than its officers. Knowledge of the officers and their companies is a valuable asset to a chief in command of the whole fire ground activity or even a segment thereof. He also goes on to state, the key to successful firefighting is anticipation. The competent officer anticipates what might happen and takes action to prevent it from happening or at least to be ready for it and minimize its harmful effect. Jeff, what's the most important position in the American Fire Service and why?
Oh, my gosh. The most important position, are you talking about by company, engine company?
Well, you have firefighters, you have company officers, you have drivers, you have chiefs, you have battalion chiefs, you have deputy chiefs, you have the fire chief of the organization. Who has the most...
Let's just break it down real quick. Okay, let's just identify a couple of positions. Company level officer, company chauffeur, driver, pump operator, whatever you want to call him, and the guy in the nozzle. Okay? Each one has to know their job as good as the next guy because we might find ourselves in that job the next day. But the company officer has got to be the one who makes sure everything comes together. It's like a coach putting a football team together. And if something fails, it should be the company officer's responsibility to be the troubleshooter. Okay? If you got a good senior firefighter in your company and he can figure it out, once again, the company officer is a fool for not letting this guy help him run the show. That takes pressure off the company officer and it makes the company as a whole look good. So I guess I'm kind of leaning towards a company officer in this respect. But let me tell you something. There's a lot of good firefighters out there who could do it just as good or better than many company-level officers out there.
Well, and I would even argue, so I lean to the company officer, but even as I say that, when I first start working with a newer company, I'll focus my conversation on the most influential person in that company in time and space, and that's the senior man.
Yeah.
Because I got almost 12 years on the job, and most of the time I'm going to be working with a senior man who's going to have 15, 20, maybe even more, and I know damn well that anybody that's sitting in the back next to that senior man is going to follow him. I don't care what rank I have on my... Am I sure? And you know what? To a certain degree, I should be following that senior man as well, as you know, provided he's an engaged firefighter who's having the right kind of influence on the rest of the company. But I know that his influence is more powerful than mine. And so, yeah, the senior man is definitely important as well. I just wanted to make that point
I had a question in 1974 as we're responding down Euclid Avenue, and we're going into a fire in a vision joint, you know, and I look across the engine, and I say to the senior man, or ask him, I says, what do you want to do when we get there? And he looks over at me, he says, follow the senior man. That was 1974. And it has stayed with me all these years. Good information to pass on, a good phrase. Remember that, okay? Remember, it goes right back to what we were saying earlier, okay? Don't let somebody come on the job with 3 or 4 or 5 years thinking that they're ready, you know, to be in charge of people's lives and property. They're not. And let's not kid ourselves about this, American Fire Service, okay? You got too much to learn out there. We're in a society right now where there's a lot of technology changes, a lot of changes overall in the way things happen, okay? Dynamics of people. Do you think I'm going to let a young person with 4 or 5 years on the job, you know, tell me what to do when I know they're wrong? Absolutely not. In many cases, when a department promotes people like that, they're just holding a position. That's all. Okay? Here's where your senior people take over and run the company, because those are the guys who will be the most efficient in this regard. So,
well, anyways. In that regard, too, as a company officer, I also know that, you know, there's a certain amount of trust that I need to earn from the firefighters. And in that process, it's going to take some time. Initially, I think most firefighters, when they come to work with a new company officer, there's just this inherent barrier that, you know, this is an authority figure. And so there's sometimes, like I said, inherent mistrust. But I know that doesn't exist with the senior man, because we're on the same, you know, footing, and the senior man has that, well, this guy has been there, done that. I'm going to just, even if it's not overt, I'm going to follow him. The things that he does, I'm going to emulate, because that's what's going to get me through another day, another fire, and, you know, what, basically, that's the culture here. The senior man is representing that. So there's an inherent trust there. As a company officer, I need to build it. Generally, the senior man already has it. So my goal is normally to get in sync with the senior man so that we can collaborate and have a more effective company at the end of the day.
What if the senior man doesn't have the same outlook you have?
Well,
he's just, I'll tell you what, he is just a senior person, that's all. And I've been in that position where I had a senior guy who was abusive. He was egotistical, he was arrogant, and he was a senior man in the house, and that's all he was to me. The guy below him, he was the real senior man to me.
But how do you work around that? I mean, he's not helping you get where you want to be.
Well, I mean, but that's the way it is in some places. I mean, you just don't go to that the guy with the most seniority. You know, if he's going to browbeat you down, you know, or whatever, you know. Now, you don't rely on him. You don't look to him and so forth, you know. He's just going to jack his jaw against you because you're a young kid instead of helping you. And that's where the guy with the next one down in seniority, that was the guy you wanted to watch. That was the guy who, you know, did his job and did it well. And you thought, oh, okay.
That's my point exactly. Just because they're the senior man doesn't make them the senior man.
Exactly. Right.
And my thought as well with the officer is, just because he's the officer doesn't necessarily always mean he's leading, or she. They have the title, but are they influencing that company in the direction to effective fire ground operations, to effective station life? You know, those are things that I constantly weigh, is what type of influence am I having on my company towards the things that matter, towards, you know, our ability to put out the fire in a quick, aggressive manner, our ability to coexist at the station, with a positive atmosphere. You know, all those things matter. And the same thing for the senior man. I think it's almost twofold. I do believe the company officer, being that he has the rank and has the decision making ability on the fire ground or status, is the most important position in the fire service, because, you know, I'll make decisions in IDLH. Sometimes chief officers don't make those decisions in IDLH. it's critical that I be on my game. And so just by that nature, that's where I'm coming from.
The company officer is the most important position in the American Fire Service. And with that said, that doesn't mean you're friends to everybody in the firehouse. You go in and you have to have the plan after seeing the members. You get assigned to a fire company and you go there for a couple of tours and you find they're lacking in X, Y, and Z, or they're not where you want them to be. If the senior man doesn't play into what you want them to be, he doesn't become part of the equation. And that's a tough sell in some fire departments. But for years, we've let places languish in that Neverland because of the senior man. You know, that's a title that's inferred by a way a fire department operates. The senior man needs to protect the officers from the men, and he would take care of the firehouse stuff so the officers didn't have to. But when I go to a place now, and I'm an officer, and I look at the people that are working there, well, whether they're mine or visiting or passing through or it's a combination department, I try to meld them into what I want them to be, because I'm the ones that are going to have to deal with them on a day-to-day basis. And when it's an issue with the people above me, then that's a fight I take on. But I have to deal with them on the fire ground. And sometimes the senior man helps me, and sometimes he's part of the problem. That's my decision to figure out where he fits in.
So that goes back pretty much to what we talked earlier when we started the show tonight. You know, what did it take? That question that you had about how did the guy keep his attitude throughout his career, despite the ups and downs, the influences, the negatives, and things like that. So, yeah. Seniority is no guarantee that you got a good firefighter. You know? And I've always used an analogy. You take, like, a big city fire academy. You know, guys graduate. And, you know, here's, make a comparison between two guys. They go to the same firehouse. It's a busy firehouse, okay? So they both spend 5 years there. One guy stays there after 5 years. The one guy looks to go out to greener pastures, moderate, you know, fire duty and things like that, okay? At the end of 25 years, you take a look at them, all right? Look where the one guy's been. Look where the other guy's been, okay? So there's your experience right there. Then you take a look at the guy's attitudes, you know? Was the guy at that busy firehouse a good senior man, or was he somebody just going through the paces, was comfortable in that setting, and that's all it was throughout those years? You know, take a look at the other guy who's in the moderately busy firehouse and what he's done throughout his career, his attitude, and what he's done for the company and things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of things here, you know, that, you know, we can point out. Anyways.
So, once we start going down more of Chief Clark's leadership axioms, there was a page that struck a particular vein with me, and I'll dissect it a little bit here. Let's dive into the text. Lack of direction. Vague and incomplete orders cause many of these fireground failures, and they are often compounded by vague and incomplete or non-existent reports of actions to the chief who gave the orders. Lack of initiative provides another cause for fire expansion or extension. There are officers who will not take an obviously required action without a direct order, and on occasion will not even request permission to take it. The situation worsens when these officers fail to notify their superiors for the need for an action. Chief officers, in fact all officers, must not be afraid of causing damage. Such fear can often lead to greater damage. On occasion, a reluctance to break windows or cut holes for ventilation has led to the total loss of the structure because firefighters were kept from moving in on the seat of a fire by heat and smoke that could have been removed by breaking windows and cutting holes. And he goes on and on about some of these, I guess I would call them timid points in our fire attack, where as you're growing into the officer role, should I do this or should I do that? That becomes a big strain, I believe, in your development and giving the orders and working through your crew, having the confidence to give them direction and know that these are the appropriate decision, having the confidence that that's what the chief would want you to do. At the end of the day, Bob, how does a officer develop a command presence?
Well, there's a lot of things that we talked with tonight. You have to be comfortable with yourself. You can't have a command presence about anything unless you understand what you're commanding. And that's, I know that sounds kind of silly, but you're an engine officer. So your job is to get the first line in service. What are all the things that you need to understand about doing that? Is your crew able to stretch? Can they pick the right size line? Can they get into position? Can you find a fire? Can your chauffeur get water? So all these things figure into, oh, I'm the first new engine. So the more that you can understand about what your job is and how to do it, the easier it is to have that presence of being an engine officer. Your first new truck officer. Well, what's your job? Search, victims, life. You know, what is command waiting for from you? Primary is negative. Primary except for the fire room is negative. That's how you get comfortable in what you do, is by understanding your job and all the parts that go into doing it. You know, a lot of what we talked about tonight keeps coming back to the company officer. Anybody can win an election, but how good are you at what you have decided to be? That's the issue. Are you comfortable with doing your job?
So, if I'm summarizing, command presence is a byproduct of your comfortability at basically your post.
Yeah, I mean, command of your company, command of the whole fire ground. You know, command presence is one of those things that we get a lot of airtime for, and it's one of those things that's thrown out there. So ask a firefighter what command presence is. Ask a company officer what command presence is. Ask a chief what command presence is. It's an ability to control the people under you, no matter what level you're at. So for a firefighter, it's taking care of yourself. Maybe the guy you're working with. For a company officer, command presence is running your company. You know, when they call for a part check, do you have to go out and fish and try to find everybody? Or do you know where your company is? Command presence for a chief is running a good fire. So it's a term that's used pretty generally, but it means different things on three different levels. So know your job, know your position, know what you're supposed to be doing, and stick to that, and you help everyone above you in their command presence.
So we're going to start.
Okay.
Go ahead, Bob.
This is Jeff.
Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
This goes back to being a competent fireman first. So as you go through your career and you get that promotion and you get that second promotion and you continue to be a competent officer now, and that comes from being a competent firefighter first, and that comes from time in the biz, and that comes from experience and where you've been and so forth, and it also comes from the person themselves. If we have time, I can make an example here. I remember being a fire one time, mixed multiple, you know, fire upstairs in this vacant suite. And the nozzle man kind of goofed up the fire. He went after it with a fog pattern when it should have been a straight stream before we thought about solid boards and stuff like that. And from being a simple one-room, nothing fire to now we got to pull ceiling, now we got to do this. We're starting to throw the mattresses out the windows and the box springs because they're burning, and a kid comes around with a fog nozzle again, blows it, you know, into a ball of fire as it jams in the window. You know what I'm getting at, right? we got a blackened out apartment now, and we hear this voice in the background. Now, there's three companies, and we've got guys in this suite doing all this work, and the captain that I was working under made a statement. I want to speak to the man in that nozzle when we're done. All of a sudden, everybody gets cleared out of the room. They heard this guy's voice. That was command presence to me. They knew there was a screw-up made by somebody, and this is what it cost us, a lot of extra work. And the bear was going to talk. And, you know, and I remember hearing that phrase also. You don't want to sandpaper the bear's ass.
So great
illustration of command presence.
One of the things you mentioned kind of piqued my interest, Jeff, and you were talking about, the firefighter needs to be competent in his role before he can become an effective officer, yeah, before he can develop command presence. And so I just kind of want to finalize our thought on this before we move into engine company operations discussion. So my experience, I thought before I transitioned as a company officer, as a firefighter, that I was a competent firefighter. Everything kind of was pointing in that direction from my experience on the fire ground. People had respect for me. I had a good work ethic. Every fire I went into, I'll be damned, it went out. Things were going just fine. When I got into the role of a company officer, I had to start making decisions. I didn't have a platform to make decisions. You know, I had, okay, yeah, I move aggressively, I work hard, and, you know, the fires go out. That just seems to always happen. But actually, like, where the line placement needed to be, what task is priority over, you know, at this point in time, in this situation, how do I decide which task is priority? Those things weren't coming to me very quickly, because I wasn't rooted as a competent firefighter. In fact, to be honest with you, I felt like when I became a company officer, I realized I was a mediocre firefighter. And so then I started drilling with my company, because I was like, well, is this true of other people in my context? You know, some yes, some no. It's variable for everybody. But I think by and large, since we didn't have a culture of drill, we had a lot of, you know, maybe those issues creeping up in other firemen. So eventually, I started becoming more competent as an officer. I started feeling like, yeah, I'm pretty well rooted in my task. I'm an aggressive firefighter now, and I'm competent in my skills, and I'm confident in them. Then I started realizing I had a leadership issue. I started realizing that I'm not doing the tasks. I'm learning them now, and I'm getting real comfortable with them. Now I can actually train other firefighters that are working for me on how to be more effective in their tasks, but I have to work through them. That's something actually Bob mentioned at the Fire Ground Officer class for FDTN. I remember Jim McCormick saying, hey, you need to accomplish tasks through your company. Well, all right, just because I know how to do the tasks doesn't mean that I can lead and influence the company to do them in the most effective manner. So I need to work on my leadership skills. So that's really where I started to really want to go, by understanding more deeply these principles and practices through the senior men that, you know, we're engaging in this podcast show.
Let me piggyback on what you're talking about. And I'm going to refer back to what I think you and Bob brought up earlier tonight about the chief officer and moving around the fire ground. And I remember a time when the chief officers were moving around that fire building, front, rear, inside, outside. They were all over it. That was their fire. You were their fireman. You were working for that guy. He was watching out for you. That chief officer would also go out to that pump panel, especially when there were multiple lines off that engine. And they would read those gauges, because what we're talking about here is where you have to be a competent firefighter before you can be a competent officer. And the old chiefs would watch for that stuff. Like I said, they weren't all good chiefs. They weren't all, you know, whatever. But the good chiefs, they knew their job, and they would do things like that. You didn't realize it if you were doing your job, but they were all over that fire ground, even at that pump panel, making sure that, you know, you weren't going to run out of water and what the pressures were, things like that.
Absolutely. And now, to be honest with you, I'm feeling more effective as a company officer, and now I'm And it's really basically because I became more competent as a firefighter first, and then now, okay, now I'm learning how to lead a little bit, but I absolutely will see things that my company's doing on the fire ground, and yeah, when they're on the right path, I let them roll. If there's something going on, I can dissect it a little bit more quickly. You know, it's becoming instinctual on, hey, I think you need to do this quick, or hey, maybe you should do that. And if it's a 50-50 thing, like the way they're doing it's different than I would, but I know based on those instincts that the outcome's going to be relatively the same, I let them roll. Because why take away from their initiative if it's going to be six to one and half dozen and another on the outcome?
Right.
So, but those are things I've had to learn, and I don't know that every company officer learns it, because I'm still a firefighter, I'm a volunteer firefighter, and I have company officers that give me direction. They're very pointed, and I know many times on some of the things that I'm doing that, you know what, it would have been the same outcome if I do it my way or your way, but now we're wasting our time talking about it, you know? So at the end of the day, sometimes we just do need to let the troops do the work, as long as the outcome's going to be the same, and just have that, you know, instinct to know and comfortability with ourselves to know that outcome's going to be the same. And I don't need to manage everything that he's doing. And in fact, it's probably hurting my ability to lead him because I'm overbearing. So something to consider. Anyways.
Yep, absolutely.
Moving into our engine ops, there's a little bit of command built into this question as well. Chief Clark starts talking about a 13-point action plan, and it really consisted of finding the fire, rescuing entrapped occupants, search for victims and extent of the fire, forcible entry, ventilation, protecting exposures, taking safety precautions, establishing communications and control, calling help if needed, confine and extinguish the fire, performing salvage operations, notifying other agencies, and 13, overhaul. And he says at the bottom, note that only two of the 13 actions call for the use of water. So, Bob, we haven't rolled you in here for a minute, so let's, do you find it odd that only two of those 13 actions involve calling for water?
Oh, I think you have to look where the chief gathered most of his information from. He was in New York City, where a lot of things were very prone to happen at once. And, you know, when you run staff engines, staff trucks, and have all these people coming at one time, you can expect a lot of things to happen at once. So as long as all those things were happening based on what the fire was telling you, you could have confine and extinguish pretty far up the line. I think the problem is with most company officers and some commanders, it's fit for the people that you have, the resources that you have, and for the fires that you have. So he was fortunate that he always had two trucks and a rescue company coming. Six companies, a lot of things could happen at once. But if you're in a one-in-one department, you're going to have to modify that list to make it work for you.
Do you, I know in previous conversations you were mentioning that there's a 13-point size up, and then this is the action plan, which is more of a 13-point command, the 13 points of command. I've got some gray area there, and you mentioned some of it in the past about, you know, there's 13 points of command, 13 point size up. How do we implement? How do we utilize both these aspects to be, I guess, more comprehensive in the way we run a scene? Can you kind of delve into that a little bit more for me?
Well, a 13 point size up is things that you evaluate to get things done. 13 points of command is the things you want to get done. Yeah. So when you look at the 13 points of command, and he mentions in, I believe it's the 10th one, to confine and extinguish the fire, well, there's a whole lot of things in your size up that determine where that should be in your command structure. When Chief Clark talked about his command structure, one of the first things he said is, all these points are interchangeable depending on the fire. Well, that's what Sizer gets you. It just so happens that both his command presence and most people's Sizer had 13 points. So you've got to look at it, whether a firefighter, a company officer, a chief officer, how you approach a fire ground. Not how to run it, what are the things that you evaluate to make you react and do things? That's a size up. When you evaluate those positions, whether it's 5 point, like below, or 13 points call as well, when you evaluate those different things, what you do with them is your decision. Chief Clark uses 13 points after he evaluates the fire ground. So his size up could be 2 points, 5 points, 13 points, but his command presence, his command operating procedures rely on 13 points that he has decided to him are the most important things to do.
Well put. So one of the things that Chief Clark discusses regarding line placement, when deciding how much hose is going to be needed, it is always better to stretch too much rather than too little. Stretching short is a frustrating experience. On the other hand, surplus hose creates problems that can be avoided by training and experience. A long-standing rule of thumb has been that from the front door of the building, there should be 150-foot length of hose for each floor up to the fire floor, plus one extra. For example, we'll pass through the example. The rule usually gives us enough hose to reach all parts of the fire floor, but if the building is large, over 100 feet in either width or length, it would be well to add another length. Hose lines, other than the first, should be taken up the outside of the building by fire escape, aerial ladder, or rope whenever practical. So, Jeff.
Yes.
Give us your take on the hook stretch versus the rope hoist versus dropping a line when considering vertical stretches.
Well, first of all, you got to know your buildings that you're working in and find out what the building will give you to work with. You know, if you're talking about an end suite, let's say it's a fire on the 6th or 7th floor, and it's going to be quicker to pull a line up from the engine up the side of the building. Is it better to go to the floor below, directly below the floor, the suite directly below the fire suite, pull your line up there, build it up, then take it up a stairwell, if there's a stairwell right close to where you're at? You know, that's one thing right there that can help you get a line in service quickly from that perspective. The hook stretch, I know we talked about this before. Unless you get a guy on every window, if you're passing it up, you know, once again, 4, 5, or 6 floors, how quickly are you going to get a guy at every window to pull that line up to where you're going with it? And then the reserve of hose that you're going to deploy up also. One of the points, what kind of a building you're working in. You know, if you're talking about a house, hell, a guy leaning over the window still puts an 8-foot hook down, hooks the bale, and then pulls it up, you know, from the ground or whatever, or the porch of the house. And that's a different animal altogether than a 4, 5, or 6-story apartment or condominium or whatever. So, but your second line, as a general rule, has been accepted in the fire service. Most people know the second line should come in behind the first line. And the first line, the second line comes in with two primary responsibilities. Number one, to make sure the first line's okay, and then if it's okay, then there for whatever, if there's extension or whatever, then it's there to, you know, be put in service and go after that one. So, and when you're talking other hose lines, other subsequent hose lines, well, that's where your rope stretch or whatever, to me, the rope stretch is probably the easiest. It employs two hitches, clove and a half, or some guys just throw a bow line in it, you know, and at the end of the rope or whatever, or a figure eight and tie it off around the nozzle, and we pull it up, you know. Sometimes, you know, we don't have to go through that flip it over 5 feet, tie the nozzle off to the hose, put another half inch in, and pull it up, whatever. Time is of the essence in many cases. You got a working fire overhead.
So just to kind of, we're gonna end on this topic, but I want to kind of delve into it to end with some good content for our listeners. So we're talking about vertical stretches, and part of me wants to have some clear direction. When do I do a vertical stretch versus a stretch via stairwell? And, you know, from my experience, your primary attack line, the first line into the structure, take the stairwell. Then we talk about second line. And I know in the past we've talked about backup line versus second line. So let's go down that. You know, backup line versus second line. What's our rhetoric? What are our thoughts regarding that line? I know, Bob, you have some thoughts on that.
Well, a couple of different things. I've always been a believer the first line has to go in the stairwell. That's not exactly for us, but it's to protect everyone else that's trying to get out of the building. They expect some relief, let's call it, in the stairwell. So my first line is always going to go up the interior stairs to the fire floor. Once that line's in position, hopefully that clears the stairwell or makes it more tenable for the civilians that are trying to get out. As far as the second line, I was always taught that the second line backs up the first, but usually with sufficient hose to go to the floor above. Mm-hmm. So the thing we always throw out is, well, what does it mean to back up the first? And does that mean over there, so we're good? So we put a lot of emphasis on that second dual engine officer. What is he looking at from the first line? And in a simple sense, it's advancement. If the first line is moving, they're not bogged down, they're advancing on the fire, I'm pretty comfortable going to the floor above. If they're stuck in a hallway or they're flowing water and they're not advancing, I'm a little slow going upstairs until I figure out why they're not moving. You know, and again, so a lot of things we talk about reverts back to that company officer. How good are you at evaluating what's going on in front of you? So you pull up second door, there's a line stretch. Well, what's your job? Get water, get a second line, make sure the first engine has water. And then I'm heading in as my crew stretches to see what the first line is doing. And if they're bogged down, not advancing, then I'm holding my line till I can figure out what's wrong with the first two engines. You know, and it's one of those unpopular things to say, well, geez, they weren't moving, but maybe they need help. Maybe they're not flowing enough water. Clogged nozzle, kinking a line.
Right, right. That's that competency in your job, in your position. That second officer on that second hose line, he's watching for that stuff. He's listening, or should be listening, for the sound of that stream hitting things. And again, you know, if you're working in narrow confines or a hallway, let's say you're in the upper floor of a building like that, is there a change in the conditions, the steam and steam production, and things like that to look for? You know, many people, Bob, they get that tunnel vision. Okay, they look at one thing and one thing only, and can't get away from that.
I think they haven't been told to look for anything else. I think that's something that we all took for granted. We learned as we went along, and it's not taught anymore because you bring some of it up, and it's like, what? What are you talking about? And it's things we take for granted, being old-timers, that now is new and exciting because no one talked about it.
Well, and that I actually agree with you 100% on that point, because when it comes, we've had this discussion before, when it comes to the backup line, you know, what I was taught and still sometimes am told to refer to is the backup line is a static position and disciplined position where you go to protect the stairwell and ensure the primary line is functioning, and your discipline is to stay put in that position. Now, obviously, on fire grounds, that hasn't always been the case. In fact, I've seen the lack of discipline, like you mentioned earlier in our show, where the second in company is actually just acting like the first in company, you know, arriving 2 seconds later, and you know they're both. Stretching to see who can get there first. So now you actually don't have a primary or backup. You have two primaries basically. And so I've seen that happen, or I've seen the opposite where, you know, there is somebody who's going to stretch that backup line. They're going to be right behind the primary. They're going to protect that stairwell and they're not moving. It isn't been discussed to me before as this dynamic process where, yep, we're disciplined to be in the backup. We're going to ensure that first line's being effective, and we're going to stretch enough to know that eventually when that first line's making progress, we need to go check for extension on the floor above. That has not been, and I don't believe is commonly taught in the fire service.
Yeah. Of course, it falls back on the company officer that has to be able to make that decision. And a lot of areas or a lot of departments, they want him to more follow in line than to think for himself. You know, I want company officers that think for themselves. I want them to make the decision. I want to train them enough to be able to make a decision so that they can go with those variables, that they can say, oh, wait a minute, they're not advancing, I better help them. But no, they're halfway through the fire apartment, but I'm going upstairs. You have that faith in the people you train, and, you know, as long as we don't, we continue to struggle with getting more things done.
And isn't it true that by ensuring that line is advancing, taking ground, you're seeing conditions change, you're seeing the compartment we're currently in being positively influenced. Now, are you not making that primary attack line more safe by ensuring there's no fire over above them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Listen, we can only play with the variables that the fire gives us. If you're halfway down the hallway and you have to make one last room, I shouldn't have to hold your hand. If you can't make that last room without me sitting in the hallway 30 feet behind you, you're in the wrong business. And that's where we should look for people to be accountable. You're an engine officer. Take your line with a firefighter that's never been to a fire before and take him down the hallway and go put out the one room fire. Me as the second due engine officer, when I see you advancing, we'll go make sure it doesn't get above me. You know, these are the values that we always had for company officers, and we've let them get skewed by people that are trying to change their job from what it is.
That's right.
A lot of it isn't rocket science. It's very, very basic.
This job has never been a science. Let's face it. We're talking about principles and practices here. We're talking about a situation that can be very dynamic, but it's also circumstantial at the same time. And it all comes down to the local conditions. And the local conditions are your staffing, your experience, your officers at the company level, your chief officers, just a lot of stuff about what we covered so far tonight. And when we take the aggressive spirit out of the firefighter and out of firefighting, we're doing ourselves a disservice, and we're doing our profession a disservice, okay? That's the one thing. So we need that voice out there that says, wait a minute, let's stop. Let's go back to aggressive firefighting, not reckless firefighting, but aggressive firefighting, and pick it up from there.
No, I think that's a perfect point to end on, Jeff. Aggressiveness on the fire ground creates a more safe atmosphere, provided we have invested in the firefighters that are on that to make the right decisions to aggressively implement them. So before I move into our conclusion of the show, let's go with what you guys are working on currently. Where can some of our audience see you in the near future? What do you got coming up on the calendar? Bob, how about you? What do you got coming up on the calendar? Anything?
Now I've got a couple of weeks and a half off here in the summer, enjoying myself, going down to spend some time in Delaware at Christiana, and hopefully catch a few fires.
Good deal. Jeff, do you got any training events coming up anytime soon that some of our audience maybe could attend?
Yeah, I'm going down for the Mickle Beg Conference outside of Orlando, and that'll be the 25th, 26th, and 27th of July. So looking forward to a great time down there with a great group of guys. So
perfect. Perfect. Well, we're recalibrating right now with the Fire Nuggets Minnesota Wisconsin affiliates. We're looking to make some relationships with some host departments, and we'll have some new events coming up on the calendar soon. So keep your eye open with Fire Nuggets. So we're going to wrap this up at this point in time. I'm sorry, I lost my place here. We're going to thank Fire Engineering, Chief Holland, for this opportunity. You can find us on Facebook at the Senior Man. So if you go to Facebook, check the Senior Man. Give us some comments, some feedback. Let us know if you have any questions. Let us know if you have any books that you want us to go over, and we can ask the Senior Man on our show some more questions that you have personally, not just mine. But thank you for joining us tonight. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Bob, thanks for joining us tonight, and thanks for your time. And Jeff, same
here.
We'll
talk to you soon. Yep.
It's been
all right.
Pleasure.
Good night, all.
Okay. Good night. Take care.